History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should never go untold. And as we keep reminding you, they really don't have to go untold if only people like you and I are willing to ask a few questions and invest enough time to let some of those remarkable memories emerge. Maybe you're going to get some time around a friend or family member this holiday season with some of those kind of stories to share. If so, why not seize the moment? There is no time like the present. This program exists, of course, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey we embark on together, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm sure I'm not the first to say Merry Christmas, but Merry Christmas. You may have guessed that that might be the theme today, and indeed it is. Americans experienced four Christmases during World War II, but the last one is the one that generally receives the most attention, primarily because of the magnitude of the Battle of the Bulge, which was unfolding at this time of year 77 years ago and coinciding with the coldest European winter on record. I couldn't help but think of the Bulge this week and think of my late grandfather and all of his fellow members of the 6th Armored Division as I toured the Fort Douglas Military Museum in Salt Lake City, Utah. This time of year, there's plenty of snow on the ground in the Beehive State, and there were a good 4 inches of white stuff lining the long barrel of a Sherman tank at the museum. It was pretty easy to imagine what it must have been like for those cold, exhausted young Americans at places like Bastogne, Belgium, all those years ago. But it wasn't just what was happening on that frozen tundra during the Battle of the Bulge. There were some pretty incredible things happening in the air and at sea on that very same Christmas. Another one of my favorite museums is not far from where I live in California. Castle Air Museum bears the name of a Medal of Honor recipient who on Christmas Eve, 1944, lived up to the words of Christmas's namesake in John 15:13, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. That's what General Fred Castle ended up doing as he piloted the lead plane in a swarm of B-17s that had been waiting for the weather to clear so they could fly in support of the ground troops during the Battle of the Bulge. Castle's Medal of Honor citation reads, he was air commander and leader of more than 2,000 heavy bombers in a strike against German airfields on 24 December 1944. En route to the target, the failure of one engine forced him to relinquish his place at the head of the formation. In order not to endanger friendly troops on the ground below, he refused to jettison his bombs to gain speed maneuverability. His lagging, unescorted aircraft became the target of numerous enemy fighters, which ripped the left wing with cannon shells, set the oxygen system afire, and wounded two members of the crew. Repeated attacks started fires in two engines, leaving the flying fortress in imminent danger of exploding. Realizing the hopelessness of the situation, the bailout order was given. Without regard for his personal safety, he gallantly remained alone at the controls to afford all other crew members an opportunity to escape. Still another attack exploded gasoline tanks in the right wing, and the bomber plunged earthward, carrying General Castle to his death. His intrepidity and willing sacrifice of his life to save members of the crew were in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service. One of the last survivors from that Christmas Eve mission returned to Castle Air Museum this year and shared his story. It's a story Ralph Graham of Waco, Texas, a radio operator with the 487th Bomb Group, has written about in his book, 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge.
8 days we would sit there with a float. Fog was so thick that you couldn't drive a truck across without some help, flashlights. All we could do is listen. And it, the report was bad every day, you know, because of the Germans. I don't want to get too far in that book because I explained that. The Germans had recognized that it was going to be how that fog. We didn't know anything about it, but a young German scientist had discovered a weather condition out over the North Sea that indicated that that was going to happen. So the German command just took advantage of it and prepared everything, tanks and everything. So when the fog came in that night, they took off and they pushed us back, and nobody realized how close driving us into the sea. That British general, he was on, it's Christmas time. He'd already gone home for Christmas. And they had to get him back. And, of course, all of our, there were three armies there that was pushing back. And if they'd pushed us back, they would have delayed us. They might not have lost the war, but they would have delayed us a long, long time.
And how much were you guys aware of, you know, in your bomb group as you're waiting for the opportunity to fly? Did you know what was happening at Bulge and how dire
absolutely.
This need was?
Yeah, we were sitting there helpless. Mm-hmm. We got the report every hour, all the time during the day, where they were and what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
If they're making a stand or if they're still giving up, still retreating. Then that morning the fog lifted just as fast as it came, you know. You could look up and go on there, the stars were shining just like diamonds, you know.
This is Christmas Eve, 1944?
That was right.
Was that unexpected when it cleared that way?
We didn't know. It just cleared up just like it came, you know.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know that it was going to clear up.
Yeah.
We were sitting there waiting and waiting, and about midnight it did. And you could hear all kind of noises, telephones ringing and communications chattering, you know, and they're getting ready for everybody for maximum effort. You know, well, we knew we might as well get up and get our clothes on.
Here we go.
That's the way it happened. They briefed us on what was happening, where we was going to go. And then from then on, my book takes over. But it didn't last too long. We pulled out on the runway to check, make our final check, and found our problem. And then we had 12 minutes to go back and get another one. And then from then on, it was a mystery.
So you're hitting it. One of the reasons the book is called 12 Minutes. So, and I've heard a lot of these stories over the years of, you know, if it didn't happen just like this, all these other things might have happened. So just so everyone understands and wants to buy the book and read a little more about it, you guys are on the runway. You're getting ready to take off. You're going to go support the troops at the Battle of the Bulge. And there's something wrong with the plane?
That's right. We had to go and pick up another plane that they have always have sitting there loaded, ready to go in case somebody has that problem.
Had you guys ever dealt with that before?
No, it's the first time. I don't know. I guess first time our squadron ever done it.
So was that a little unsettling?
It really was. We didn't know what was happening because there was a new plane. The women had just flew it in from the States, hitting several others. We didn't understand. We didn't know what was I didn't know what was going on anyway. But later he told me what it was.
What was it?
You know, your alternator on a car, if it goes out, you don't have any power.
Right.
When you're sitting on the ground, you're on batteries. But once you're ready to take off, the batteries, you can't go with you. You're depending on electrical current.
Right.
And we checked them, and it always going to fall a little bit, you know. But this one went plumb pegged down. That means you may not even get off the runway, depending on how much, what it was putting out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't take any kind of a chance.
So you guys have to go back. And everybody gets off this B-17. You transfer onto another one.
Right, and it took about 12 minutes.
Uh-huh. How big a difference did that 12 minutes make?
Well, it made a lot. We started, I thought we ought to abort, because you could take a pencil and a tablet and figure out yourself in small and just arithmetic. There wasn't no way we could catch them before they get to the target.
Because you've got a whole group of B-17s.
They're 40 miles ahead, and we'd had to make up that time. And we came 225 miles as fast as you can go with a load. If we had to increase that enough to get there, we wouldn't have made it anyway.
So you're not going to catch up and become part of the formation.
That's
just
right.
Not going to happen.
So we flew on. No, I didn't know what we were going to do. And we got a call from him.
From General Castle?
General Castle said, we're under attack. Well, the pilot said, well, now what we should do? He said, just join another crew. Well, it wasn't long after that till he was shot down. Tried to contact him, but he was done gone.
So if you had been with the original group of planes, you would have been part of that fighter attack as well.
That's right, and I'll tell you, as we go along, we went ahead and finally made it. It was pretty tough to even join another group because they don't like to see a single plane come up to join without reporting why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Germans did take one of them old planes that crashed and pick it up, and they'd come back and fly it and get into contrails and cause a lot of problems, you know.
Sure.
So we joined them, and it was, we'll know what our armor was. We told him we was carrying 2 500-pounders. He said, that's what we need. We're going to knock a bridge out over a certain river. We didn't know what river it was because we wouldn't brief for that mission, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we did. We knocked it out and came back and finally went home. And when we got home, we found out what had happened, that they had said they'd knocked down 9 planes. Well, said 4 of them that was knocked down by the German fighters, and the rest of them had force landed or bailed out there at Liège. It was a little town outside of Brussels. And we found out that they had made that mistake. They thought we was down because of our squadron commander, who didn't fly that day, looked at us and says, "I'm looking at a ghost." Says, "Y'all was reported dead, down, or missing." Nobody knew whether it was which one it was. And as far as I was concerned, I tried to figure out why he didn't report it.
He didn't report us as missing,
mm-hmm. but he didn't report it that there was SD-8 planes. Because we was in the 9th.
You would have been the 9th plane, but instead there were only 8.
That's right. There's only 8 because we was they thought they was right, and they were, because there was only 4 reported back.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take 4 and you add us, and that's 5, and you subtract that from 13, you get 8. See? That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, and nobody ever knew the difference. They even made a report article on that mission, and they still reported 9 planes missing. And then I got a little piece of that letter in my book. If you magnify it and see whether they still said 9 planes missing.
And that was the official Army Air Corps report of the mission?
That's right. That was such a mixed up thing, you know. In addition to that, we had 50 airplanes that came in and landed on ours. And there we were. Christmas was even. Christmas Day was next day, and they was boiling turkey and everything getting ready. But the confusion just wiped out any reason for any of them to ever doubt, other than that fact that he told us.
So let me understand. So you guys go ahead. You join another group. You're not with your squadron. You're flying with another group. You drop your 500-pound bombs on the target, and then you're flying back to your base. But when your pilot brings the plane down and you land, you get off, you guys see the squadron commanders?
Yeah, that's right. He walked into the headquarters.
Uh-huh.
Our pilot did.
When your pilot walks in.
He looked at, and they were good friends. He said, "Man, I'm looking at a ghost."
Mm-hmm.
Because they were already reported, as quick as it happened, that the one that took over reported the one that wasn't there. They knew who was flying, and they knew the one that joined them was 4 planes. That's how come them to sank. Well, there's 9 planes missing. They didn't know. Say nobody had any idea that we wasn't in the group. Avon Castle didn't know until he called us and called everybody and said, "We're under attack." And we was listening, and we called him back. And he said, "Just go on around." We told him he was 40 miles away. "Just go ahead and join another group."
So, you've had a lot of time to think about this.
Absolutely.
I imagine you may have some different emotions for different aspects of it. What are some of the things you think about when you consider that twist of fate or the uniqueness of the difference that 12 minutes made in your life and others?
I wrote it down. It's in there. And I said this: the Germans had 8 days that they didn't fly. We had 8 days we didn't fly. You had any time to make proposals on what to do. The Germans prepared too. But when it came to be, the Germans was prepared. We wasn't. Because who's going to send out the whole 8th Air Force being led by a squadron that didn't have one escort plane? Mm-hmm. But yet there was thousands of them in the area, but we didn't have one. Now, the tale was that they were supposed to join us at a certain point, but the fog had not lifted in that particular area, and they couldn't get off the ground. We should have had escort from the time the wheels up on takeoff,
mm-hmm.
because we was leading the whole 8th Air Force in. Castle was.
How much did you know about him at the time?
I didn't even know him. See, he came down from wing headquarters to fly that one mission. We didn't know who was wing. That, you know how many planes that is or how many? That's 3 groups.
Right.
And 3 groups, you're talking about, we had 39 planes. Multiply that from 3, that's over 100. And he was in charge of that. But he came down to fly that one mission, leading everybody in.
And he didn't have to.
No. He was a brigadier general.
Right.
He just made general.
What does that say about him, that he wanted to be there leading that mission, even though he'd already flown all those missions and accomplished so much and didn't need to be out there doing what he did?
Well, they said that he had flown more bad missions than anybody. I said, well, you know, time will get you. But when he went down, he was very calm. about what was happening. And then, of course, next thing we knew, they were bailing out.
And you were hearing this on the radio?
No, that's what people told us, you know, that was in the mission. In fact, one of them I met later on at San Antonio when we had a reunion, was a waste gunner, I think, and he said he was one of the that bailed out. But they said he couldn't have never got out because both feet was on fire.
Mm.
But even with that, he wanted to guide that plane away from anything on the ground because we was over friendly territory, you know. He wanted to guide it into an open field. That's what he had told the co-pilot. He says, y'all go, I can't get out. He says, I'll take it in. That's what makes you want to keep this thing going.
That's why you're here.
Mm-hmm. That's the reason why we're here today.
So what do you think about when you see his name out there?
Well, that's where heroes were born. I mean, you think about it, the first thing you think about then is, I don't know how many we got, but there's a man that knew he was going to die, and he did what he did for a purpose. He knew he couldn't make it because he couldn't even walk to the bailout. So it makes you wonder, even though I didn't know him, I had never known him, I didn't know who that Castle was. Well, I learned to respect him, being a part of our efforts.
Well, and for you, okay, so General Castle was a hero. He knew that he was giving his life for our country.
And I knew that. Mm-hmm.
What would have happened to you if that first plane you guys tried to take off in would have been okay, and you would have been in the formation? What do you really think?
I suppose that I would be like all the rest, that you would do what the best thing that you could do.
What was that Christmas like, the day after that mission?
Well, that's in the book, too. We knew we went in. The crew had just came in. They was in the same Quonset hut with us. In fact, the night before, we played pinochle and became acquainted with them pretty good. Well, we come in that night. Of course, they wasn't there. And it's our job to pick everything up, that's their personal stuff, and mail it home. But it was so quick, we didn't know whether they might have bailed out. We didn't want to start doing anything until we found out what happened to them. But it was a pretty dark day. We was going to have a Christmas party. And, of course, we had all the stuff laying on the cot. And instead of having a party, we just took all that stuff that the kids would like and carried it down to the orphan's home and gave it to them and come back and got ready for another mission the next morning because we had to keep doing something. You know, you can't sit there and fret, you know. As bad as it was, you still got to look ahead. Just keep on keeping on. That's all. I've tried to help people if I can. That's what I want to do, help as many people as I can and let them see what can happen when you got faith and you try to live it. You know, if you just ask for strength to do it, you can do it.
It's time for our first break, but more Christmas connections from World War II when we come back. As so many were freezing and fighting at the Battle of the Bulge, sailors in the Pacific were up against an enemy far more powerful than Imperial Japan. Typhoon Cobra, which claimed more than 800 American lives. Hear from one man who survived against all odds when his destroyer went under when this special Christmas edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR, has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Christmas weekend edition of the program. At this time 77 years ago, the weather was as big a factor as enemy firepower. Whether you were in frozen foxholes in Europe during the Battle of the Bulge or on some of the wildest seas of all time in the Pacific, Halsey's Typhoon, or Typhoon Cobra, occurred just before Christmas in 1944. Pat Doohan was one of those fortunate enough to survive from a trio of sunken destroyers which, as the typhoon started to rev up, were starting to experience rolls of 70 to 80 degrees that made the ship's ultimate fate seem unavoidable. Pat was on the USS Hull.
Well, what happened? We'd take a roll like that, and then a wave underneath would push us back up.
Uh-huh.
And we knew we lost some men overboard during the night over the fantail. And I did probably a very stupid thing, or maybe it saved my life. But in the middle of the morning, I'd been on the bridge all night. And, of course, we didn't have any food or water or anything up there, or coffee, which is something you can't do without, but we had to do without because it was impossible to make coffee in the galley. I said, I'm going to go back and get some sack time. So being an open deck destroyer, one of the old ones, we had an open deck to the after part of the ship. Well, the ship was on a roll, and I made a dash, and I could have easily been washed overboard, but I grabbed a hold of one of the torpedo tubes, and made my way into the after deck house. Then I went down, got in my sack, and I got immediately thrown out when the ship rolled. So I went up on topside in what we call the after deck house, and was there with about 20 or 30 of my shipmates in that little compartment.
What did the mood seem to be on the ship? Did you see fear in people's eyes?
Fear and uncertainty. And I think on the bridge that night, it was uncertainty, and it was a fact that we had somebody that didn't know what they were doing. And the older men, they say, hey, we're in a bad place. And when the barometer drops like it did, why, the old sailors that were been in the Orient, and they knew what we were in for. And when you're taking water and you're wanting to jettison like the whaleboat on the side, and the captain wouldn't let you, and it was finally broken away and went over the side anyway, and one of the chiefs wanted everybody to put on their life jackets, and you have the captain say, what are you doing, trying to scare my crew? Why, you know.
No, trying to save their lives.
Uncertainty. And so it was kind of havoc up there on the bridge that night. But when I got in that after deck house, why, the guys were either praying or crying or cussing.
Yeah, that pretty much runs the gamut.
Right.
Covers it all. Now, how long did this go on?
Well, it went on. I got up in the after deck house, in that after part of the ship. We went over around noon. And when the ship would roll, one of the hatches was broken off and the water would come in. And then when it straightened up and go, the water would go out. And when it finally went over, I was fortunate. I had a hold of the handle on one of the hatches. And there was an air vent above. Well, I put my foot in that air vent and hold of that handle. But I couldn't get the hatch open. Here, water was coming up. Well, the latches on the hatch, or we call them dogs, they're kind of big handles. A lot of my shipmates had a hold of those. And there's no way, I had to kick their hands off. That still bugs me today, because I had to kick their hands off. They dropped down the water in order to get that hatch open. I don't know how many of those survived. I mean, it just...
Even though none of them could have gotten out unless you did that,
none of them,
you don't know if they made it or not.
I don't know. I know some of them made it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got the hatch open, it came back on my back, and several scooted out and didn't come back and pull it off of me. Finally, one fella did, and I was meaty, and I had no life jacket.
So you were almost trapped in there by the hatch itself.
Right. And I had no life jacket. My life jacket was on the bridge. I left it up there all night. And it had a flashlight and a whistle on it, which we were issued. And so when I came out of there...
Hold on. And I don't want to get in the way of... And I know you've got this memorized up here, but I just want to dwell on this for a second. So you pull the hatch open, but the pressure of the water pins you. The hatch has you pinned. You can't move, right?
Can't move.
What is going through your mind at that moment?
Am I going to make it? Yet, I never gave up hope that something that I just had, I never gave up hope. By then I'd come back to the States one time. One time we came in for a short visit. I got married. I married the girl I was going with before the war, Fresno girl. And she was pregnant when we left after our yard overhaul, which 13 other wives were that I knew of. Only three of us came back. Anyway, I had hope. I knew that I just couldn't give up.
You had a wife and a baby you hadn't met.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Expecting a baby.
Uh-huh.
But, there's one thing that I think helps. I had a lot of faith from above, plus the fact I was a swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And water itself doesn't bother me. The elements, but the water itself.
Did it seem like an eternity before someone came and pulled that hatch off you?
It seemed like an eternity. And when I came out of there, like I said, I didn't have a life jacket, but there was one spare life jacket tied to a gun. And somebody up there put it there for me, and I slipped it on. And I was immediately washed up midships, then washed clear of the ship.
Now, when you say somebody put it there, do you mean one of the fellow sailors put it there?
Somebody up above put it there.
It was divine intervention.
Right.
Was there any reason for it to be there?
They usually had several extra life jackets tied to guns around there, but why that one was there at that one spot.
So you come through the hatch.
I came out the hatch, and the ship was on its side at that time.
Uh-huh.
And
can you see? What can you see? Can you see anything?
You see the whole side of the ship all the way up to the... It was over on its side, and I got washed up midships. And then another wave. Then about that time, one of my shipmates, one of those big old life jackets, had him jammed against the side of the ship, and we couldn't get to him to pull it off. And the last thing I remember, he raised his fist in the air and yelled, "Fight on!" He was a Pearl Harbor survivor, and he was one of the greatest guys on ship, but his favorite words was, "Fight on!" And that's the last I saw him.
Hmm.
We couldn't break it loose.
But you were able to get that life jacket on.
I totally, yes.
And then how did you get off the ship, or did the ship take care of that for you?
The ship took care of that. I was washed free of the ship, and I was out there, and there was a lot of sailors in the water, and there was life jackets or life rafts around, and I grabbed a hold of one big life raft, but it was tied to another life raft, and these big, huge life rafts, when they would bang together, I saw some of my shipmates' heads pop open like popcorn.
Ugh.
And I let go immediately. And then a wave came up between me, and I didn't see anybody from then on. I did feel the ship going down on my body. I mean, you could just feel when it hit the depth,
why
you could feel, feel exploding. And
Did it disappear from your view pretty quickly?
Yes, it went down. And pretty soon all of a sudden, felt like I was being sucked down deep and deep. And being in the middle of a task force, I didn't, and you couldn't see. The rain was so fierce, it was just cutting your face if you looked into it. And all I could think of, I'm being drawn into the propellers of another big ship going by. And you could just think, you're just drawn deeper and deeper down at the depths, and there's no way of stopping it. And you fear that, and then all of a sudden you're shot to the surface. Well, after that happened twice, I realized I was going up a wave, and one of the tops, the crest of the waves, was breaking over me and shoving me down.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, I'd double up when that would happen, it would hurt my ears, but it only happened a couple more times.
We think about the movie Titanic or something like this, and you see the people calmly floating and watching all the devastation around them. You're still in the middle of a typhoon, and the rain is cutting into your face. So what is going through your mind at the time? What are you trying to do?
Well, trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
The typhoon hadn't hit its peak until we'd been in the water for about an hour or so. And so we were right in the middle of it. And after I got away from that life raft that we're banging together, why, I was alone. And pretty soon the storm started a little bit subsiding, and it was getting darker, and here I was, can you imagine being out in the middle of South Pacific in just a life jacket, all alone, and getting dark?
No, thank you. Oh, yeah, and then there's those things called sharks.
Sharks and barracuda that you worry about. Well, the storm had subsided, and I was alone, and I didn't see anybody. And all of a sudden, something hit me in the back of the neck. And I was terrified. I thought, I'm going to be hit by a shark. Well, it was dark then. I reached back and grabbed it, and it was a broom from the wreckage. And it was put there for a reason. You know, hours floating right there, why, your legs get pretty numb. So I was able to hold the broom between my hands and rest my feet on the shoulders of that broom and raise them up. So the broom was there for a reason.
Sent to you by the same person who left the life raft with the gun.
Right.
The man upstairs.
Man upstairs. And I continued floating, and I saw a big searchlight. As oh boy, somebody knows the ship went down. And I saw that searchlight going back and forth, and pretty soon must have been in a fast current, because pretty soon I was over the horizon, and I didn't see it anymore. Later on, I found out it was a Tabor. It was also pretty near broken up DE that picked up a good number of my shipmates and other off of the other ship, too.
And that was the time at which the Tabor was picking people up?
Yes. What they thought, their antenna was broken off, their mast had broken off, so when they were getting ready to repair it, they saw this little light, and they thought a man was washed overboard. So they finally maneuvered and picked him up, and he said the hull went down. That was at 10 o'clock at night. That was the first time anybody ever knew any ship went down. And so they immediately started looking for other survivors, and they heard some of the whistles, and they started picking them up, and the next day Halsey ordered them to rejoin the fleet. But the good old captain, young captain, he disobeyed Halsey's order three times, and he picked up 56 men.
And thank the Lord he did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if Halsey said that. But
a little later on, I was drifting, it was dark, and I saw this little light, little bitty light, like a flashlight. So we were issued one-cell flashlights and a whistle to put on our life jacket, but since my life jacket was on the bridge and I had a spare one, I didn't have it. So I yelled, and they yelled, "Who is it?" And I told them, and I made my way over to it, and they pulled me in. It was some of my shipmates on one of these big rafts with the bottom pretty near broken out of it. But I got in it with them, and I felt good about that.
But I meant that wasn't what you were hoping for when you heard someone else's voice.
No. But
that's kind of like, wow, I'm getting rescued. Oh, I'm still stuck in the ocean.
Yeah, and we were stuck there. The next morning at daylight, the first thing we saw was 12 and 14-foot sharks, dorsal fins, circling us. Every once in a while, they'd make a pass at us, you know, turn over, and they could have easily gone underneath that raft and got our legs, but they didn't. They just were biding their time, I believe. We could talk to each other. Two of them drank salt water and died from exposure, and we let them drift away. And you say something or say a prayer and let them go, and you know they're going to be gone. And we drifted several days, and some of the guys were going to go a little bit nuts at various times, hallucinating. And I think the last night out, pretty near everybody was in that frame of mind. One fellow went outside the raft, and the shark tore his arm up, and we got him back in. The last day out, one of the fellows said, "There's a bunch of ships on the horizon over there," and he pointed over there. He said, "Oh, you're nuts like everybody else." Well, we rubbed the salt out of our eyes, and sure enough, we saw some ships over on the horizon, just the stacks and the smoke. And about that time, two carrier airplanes came over, circling, you know, watching for submarines ahead of the fleet. And they passed over us, but, you know, they were so high up, a man looks like a little thumbnail in the ocean. But pretty soon they made a circle, and they came right down at water links, and they wiggled their wings, and we knew we'd been spotted.
They waved at you.
They waved at us, and pretty soon a big cloud of smoke went up from this fleet over there, and we knew a destroyer had lit off its boilers, and destroyer men, you know, when you see that big cloud of black smoke, you know something's coming. Well, a big, beautiful USS Brown pulled up alongside of us, and they threw us a line, and when they threw us a line, started pulling over to us, the sharks went into a frenzy, and they had to break out guns and just start firing to keep the sharks away from us. And so they got us up, they helped us up the rope ladder, And we got on deck, and of course, we're macho men, you know. Nothing wrong with us. We don't need two guys on each side of us. Let go of me. Well, they let go of me. I hit the deck immediately. I needed some help.
Well, how long had you been in the water now? Three and a half days?
3.5 days, yeah.
Holy cow.
With no food or water. See, that water was the bad thing. Food you can do without, but water you can't. So they took us in. The first thing they did was give us a shot of whiskey, which burned all the way down.
I imagine.
And then they gave us sips of water. I went to the Browns' first reunion a number of years ago, and the guy that gave me that sip of water wanted to have a picture taken with me, give him that sip of water. So then they immediately, they were getting low on supplies, but they broke out their best the next day, and they gave us some food, and each guy gave up a sack for us. A little bit later on, they picked up the only six survivors from the Monahan.
Mm-hmm.
They were 20 minutes later, they picked those guys up. They were a good bunch of guys.
And so by this time, you've realized our ship's gone, the Monahan's gone, the Spence is gone.
We didn't know about the Spence.
Okay.
We didn't... They, in fact, each man gave us a sack, and the fellow whose sack I'm in, he gave up. I'm still good friends with him.
How about that?
He lives in Sacramento. We visit once in a while. But anyway, they took us into Ulithi and took us over to the Solus, one of these big hospital ships painted white with a red cross on the side of us. And like I say in the letter, Christmas Eve, we were carried on board the Solus and stretchers, and the nurses singing Christmas carols. I'll never forget that.
We've heard from a few different veterans here over the years who have strong wartime memories associated with Christmas carols. But not all of those experiences involving holiday music were pleasant ones. We'll hear both sides of that spectrum when this special Christmas edition of Hometown Heroes returns right after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma, you can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back, Hometown Heroes, finishing up a special Christmas edition of the program. One thing that was unfolding 80 years ago this week, the saga of Wake Island, that Pacific outpost where servicemen and civilians alike were overrun by the Japanese. Joe Goicoechea had gone to Wake Island as a civilian contractor. This first of his four Christmases in captivity would represent a very rude awakening.
December the 8th we was hit. December the 23rd we gave in, and we knew around 22nd or 23rd that it was getting close, because they said, boy, the ships will be here in 24 hours or something. It never would show up. So after a while, you just gave up on it.
And I'm sure you never had contemplated spending Christmas as a prisoner of war.
They took us to the airport, all of us. They had machine guns around us and all, and we thought, boy, this is it, you know. And we wasn't in too good a shape. I wasn't, in a way, and a lot of other guys worse than me. What we were told later, that the Japanese got orders from Tokyo to not to kill us. So then on Christmas Day, 24th or 25th, we all marched to our camp, the good camp that we lived. But it was the barracks and everything. It was hit pretty hard and all. But you could still go in and seek shelter, you know, from the sun and rain and so forth. And that's where we went, and then we went on details. Japs had us go on details, because they wanted to know where those Oki guns were. Oki means big in Japanese. Well, the biggest guns we had is a 5-inch. We told them none, but we went different places and found different things. We found a lot of our dead guys that crawled back in their holes and died. They were wounded, you know. And after a while, in the heat and everything, a man kind of smells a little bit. Boy, I tell you, it's terrible.
I know what happened to you from there. You were a prisoner of war until the end of the war, from the start of the war to the end of the war. If you had known that then, if someone had told you you were going to be held captive for nearly 4 years from that point, would you have believed that you could make it that long in those conditions?
No, I didn't even give it any thought.
Because you have no idea. I mean, this could go on. You could be never get out of a POW situation.
Our mentality was different. We just seemed to be full of cement. Just solidified our head was and everything. Hell, and then some of them kind of went a little nutty. And so it takes all kinds of people.
And I know you ended up in four different prisoner of war camps at the hands of the Japanese, and I know there are a lot of stories you can share from that, and I want to hear a few of them, but I'm curious, when you look at that in the big picture, when you look of surviving 44 months as a prisoner of war with very little to eat, not always treated very well, what did you think about that kept you believing you could still have a life after this? Because a lot of guys, as you said, it made them go nuts. They didn't survive. You made it through. Why was that? What was your key?
Attitude. Oh, gosh. I used to joke with the Japanese. We met some good Japanese that didn't have to be good to us. We'd tell them all kinds of stories. They asked me if I was married, and I said, yeah. And I got two wifos. And another Jap, a few days later, asked me about it, and a wifo, and I said, yeah. Three or four, I tell them different stories. And one, if I had any kids, and I said, yeah. So one time, about three or four of those Jap soldiers had come over there, and ones I talked to at different times, in a week or 2 week time, they looked at me and everything, shook their head and said, dummy done, nah, he's crazier than hell.
Finally figured you out, huh?
Yeah, but that sense of humor, that's what I feel that kept me alive. I kept going. I prayed a lot. I'm a pretty Christian. I mean, I always did pray. I was taught to pray, and I always did pray. And I feel that's the reason I'm here.
What do you pray in a situation like that?
Gosh, it's hard to tell you. You're praying for yourself, that's for sure.
Get me out of here?
Save me and this and that. And oh, you were scared of being wounded, seriously. That was it, because we had no way. We had two doctors there and the medics, but the hospital was blown up. Everything was taken out to take care of them. They had really no way to really take care of the wounded soldiers, or wounded people, I should say. God, some of them are in bad shape. A lot of them lost a leg or an arm or something.
Four different camps and 44 months as a prisoner. What would you say was the hardest thing to endure? I'm sure you didn't have very good things to eat. I'm sure you lost a lot of weight. But what was the most challenging or most threatening experience that you faced?
Well, so much. In the first year, we was in China, the prison camp there at Wusung. It was cold, icy. We had no clothes. Our feet, gee whiz, just almost cry with the pain in your feet and stuff. And it was miserable. And they gave us two blankets, each prison. You could put those blankets and see through them. Two of you get together. You put a blanket underneath on the deck, wooden deck, and then you put the others over. You never take your clothes off. If you had any other clothes, you put them all on. But that was the first winter in China.
And again, that was just the first of four Christmases he spent as a prisoner of war. Just throw that in your perspective as you evaluate your own outlook this holiday season. We'll hear from another ex-prisoner of war for whom one particular Christmas carol has strong meaning in a moment. But first, a sailor who spent the final 75 years of his life cringing any time he heard Bing Crosby singing this.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Of course, the whole point of that song, White Christmas, was to bring comfort to many a serviceman longing to be back with his family during World War II, and it did. But for Mike Wanty aboard the USS Lardner, that song became associated with a young man who paid a heavy personal price for the cause of our freedom.
And I don't like to talk about it, and if I do tell you, I may crack in talking about it, but I'll tell you, it happened at Christmas time. This is why I hate Christmas, in a way. I don't know if I can tell you or not. Mm. It happened at Bougainville. We helped the Marines go ashore, and then the bodies started coming back, and they would come back in baskets. And one of you shouldn't have done this. This boy, they put on the wardroom table. He had no arms, no legs, and he was burned over most of his body. And all we could do was give him morphine. And he wanted to hear White Christmas all the time. It was a record. He would play over and over and over and over. And it took us about 10 hours, I guess, to get to a forward hospital on Vella La Vella. And the doctor said to me, he says, I won't let him die, Mike. I'll get him ashore. And he did, but he died once he got there. But he didn't die on the ship. I've always felt bad. I never got his name or his father and mother. I've always wanted to write to her. He was about 17, Marine, nice young guy.
It's okay. I'm sorry, Mike.
You don't realize. I happens if I ever think about it. And at Christmas time, it's double. They keep playing White Christmas. I've gotten used to it. But to talk about it, it's different.
But over the years, if you're somewhere and White Christmas comes
you
on,
you never can forget it.
You said your whole life you've wished you had gotten his name so you could have written his mother. What do you think you would have written to his mother? What would you have told her?
That he was brave and he thought of his family. He was a farm boy. I think from Ohio.
Mike Wanty explaining why that song, White Christmas, triggered so many painful memories for him over the years. Don Cooley is on the other side of that spectrum, part of a massive surrender of troops from the 106th Infantry Division that had become surrounded during the Battle of the Bulge. Cooley had a different piece of Christmas music seared into his memory for a very different reason.
My job as a battalion clerk, I happen to have in my pocket another blank sheet called a morning report where you list the names of everybody. And so I passed this thing around the boxcar and had everyone sign it that was in there. I think there were 60 of us then. The third day we were strafed because the boxcars were not labeled. And these were, we think, British plays. So they opened the doors and we got out to dive in the ditch. Yeah, it was cold by then. But the point I want to make is that they did run along this train, long train, and open up the doors when the strafing occurred. The trouble is, strafing's over before they could get to two or three cars.
And when you say these boxcars aren't labeled, what you're saying is if they had said POW on the top
Red Cross.
Or a Red Cross, then the planes would have known not to shoot.
That's right.
But they don't know.
They don't know.
And so you guys are helpless inside this boxcar, and if they don't open the doors, you're going to have a lot of guys die.
That's right, or you hope that pilot is a bad shot. Some guys took off at that point and didn't come back to the boxcar.
Did you think about trying that?
Not a bit.
Why not?
Well, I think it was because if I had thought about it, I think I would have nixed it, because I think it was the fourth day into Germany, third or fourth. That's a pretty long way to get back through the lines.
So you knew.
And no food.
And wherever you're going to be, it's German-held territory. So the likelihood of you getting through all that and back to American territory is rough. And are you getting pretty hungry by now?
Yes.
Are you getting scared?
No, I don't think so. We were with friends. That helped so much.
Well, and you said you celebrated your 21st birthday in a boxcar. I don't think that's how most young men imagine spending their 21st birthday.
Well, I wouldn't interview very many people with that question, but I think I know the answer, so I don't need to.
Did it occur to you that it was your birthday? Did you mark the occasion?
Oh, sure. The day after Christmas.
Well, I guess I should ask you about Christmas, too, then, huh?
Well, there was a significant thing. We started singing Christmas carols in the boxcar, and I get emotional about that. There was another fellow among our group, had a good voice and knew the words, but pretty soon other people chimed in. And the irony, of course, is that that's a German carol, Silent Night.
So you're somewhere in Germany, you're prisoners in a boxcar, freezing and starving.
Well, we weren't freezing in there. From that standpoint, we were better off than the soldiers that didn't get caught. It got down to the coldest winter to date there in Germany, and we were sheltered. And that was something to be thankful for.
But here you are, 60 GIs, singing Silent Night inside a boxcar?
Yeah. Well, it was Christmas.
How did it sound?
They didn't sing happy birthday to me the next day, but I don't think I told them anyway. They might have. You know, what do you do? You're just there all day sitting on your duff and chatting. Because we were in that boxcar for 9 days.
Well, and I imagine you've probably heard Silent Night hundreds of times in the 75 years since then.
Sure. Wonderful song.
Can you listen to it now without thinking of that boxcar on Christmas 1944?
No.
And what do you think about when your mind goes back to that moment with
those
guys?
Oh, I cloud up.
You might be the only one from that boxcar who's still here.
It's very possible.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or make it more than it was, but I can sense just from your description and your emotion that this was a real powerful moment for you.
Oh, yes.
What did it do for you?
Made me feel better, probably.
Gave you a little sliver
and
of hope.
And also, it was another bond with the others who were singing with us, which we needed at that time.
Ever since I heard that story from Don Cooley, I picture that scene he described every time I hear Silent Night. Before we run out of time on this Christmas edition of Hometown Heroes, just one more encouragement for you. Chances are there's somebody in your network of friends and family who's part of our armed forces right now and maybe not able to gather with family the way most of us get to. Why not take just a few minutes and let them know that they've been missed at your family holiday gatherings? And if you're a praying person, maybe say a little prayer for them as we conclude this Christmas season. I guess I can be one of the first to wish you a happy new year as well, and we'll look forward to many more veterans sharing their stories over these very same airwaves in 2022. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.